Okay, today is the 25th of September. I'm Carrie Klein, here with my husband and partner, Michael Klein, who's taking notes here. Could you tell us your name?
Astrid Williams.
My name is?
My name is Astrid Williams.
Okay, and your date of birth, to put this in some perspective?
Sure, April 12th, 1959.
Okay. And tell us about your people and where you were raised.
Okay. I grew up in Vermont, in a small town called Faiston, which is associated with Waitsfield, Vermont, which was at the base of Three Ski Areas, Sugarbush, Mad River, and Glen Ellen.
Base of what? I'm sorry?
Of Three Ski Areas, Sugarbush, Mad River, and Glen Ellen Ski Areas. So I grew up in Vermont with my parents and two brothers until I left for college in 1977.
And then their names?
My father is Arthur Williams, and my mother was Hannah Nielsen Williams, and my brothers are John Williams and Nathaniel Williams. And my parents moved to Vermont from Connecticut to start teaching school in a one-room schoolhouse in Vermont, and my father was one of the first founders of Sugarbush Ski Area. So we stayed there and grew up skiing, and my father went on to be a state legislator and then ran the Vermont Council on the Arts until his retirement. And my mom was worked for the Associate of Architects in Vermont. And I went to the local elementary and high school there, and then on to New England College in Henniker, New Hampshire, for my college degree. And then when I left college, I moved to Concord.
Would you do a thing like that?
Yeah. My best friend from college was a year ahead of me and moved to Concord. And I wanted to get out of Vermont. I felt like I was, as my parents said, too big a fish in a small pond. So I moved to Concord just following a friendship from college and fell in love with it and have stayed here on and off ever since.
That would have been the early
70s? So I graduated in 1981 from college, so in 1981 I moved here.
Sorry, I skipped a decade.
Yeah. So graduated from high school in 77 and then moved here in 1981. And then moved into Boston when I was single, moved back out here when I was married, did two brief stints in San Diego, California for America's Cup, and then moved back here to Concord again. So it's been, I'm considered an old timer now by a lot of Concord standards.
Well, what kind of a big fish were you, and what was Concord like in 81?
Well, you know, growing up in a small town in Vermont, you know, everyone knew each other. And so I was wanting to stay in Vermont because I felt, you know, that that was where my roots were and that's where everyone knew me. But I moved to Concord and, it was much smaller than it is now. I mean, there's a lot less building. I mean, some of the older, you know, the historic downtown was the same. But there's been a, you know, significant growth, like in every community, since 1981. And I rented houses in West Concord and then over on Garfield Road and then bought our first home here on Monument Street. And then I've now lived in West Concord again and now on Elm Street, so I've moved around a little bit in town.
What was West Concord like in the early 80s?
A lot as it is now. I mean, sort of had the same downtown feel to it, the West Concord 5 and 10. Some of the same, a few of the same stores were still there. The West Concord supermarket was there then. I actually walked to the train and was taking the train into Cambridge when I first got out of college to work at a bank. But the infrastructure hasn't changed a lot in the downtown area, except recently there's obviously a lot of new building going on sort of behind the main facade of West Concord. But it's a lot more crowded now. There are a lot more commuters, a lot more people coming in to, you know, Concord and staying here now with big apartment buildings. So I think the whole commuting scene is different, and the amount of people you know and don't know has significantly changed since I, you know, was here.
Mm-hmm.
More commuters now, yes. And we've, Concord's had a significant growth in affordable housing and public housing since I first moved here. So you're seeing a lot more people who are coming here either by choice or by Section 8 housing. So there's more, people trying to, come here to work, and then get into Boston to work. And no development now, as you've probably heard, goes. Multiple units of housing don't happen here without affordable housing attached to them. So you'll see it's a higher density population and bigger structures than we ever saw before. And my previous job was very much concerned with people in those types of situations that were sort of put here because that is where they were told to go or could afford to go. And in my human service work, I really saw that population most significantly.
Your human service work?
So I ran the Concord-Carlisle Community Chest, which is a local nonprofit that has been around for about 66 years now. It was started in 1947, and it was really the first offshoot of the United Way. So before the United Way became the United Way, it was really community chests like your Monopoly board, and they were the major fundraiser for all human service organizations in town, and I took over as executive director in 1997 and directed that organization for 16 years. So we raised over $500,000 a year and gave it out to any organization that was serving Concord and Carlisle residents and was a not-for-profit. So I really got to see the amount of need in town and how that grew and changed and, as part of history. I mean, this organization really did the only fundraising for the hospital when it was originally founded. So I've seen the significance and the amount of nonprofits that have started here in town in the last 16 years. Sort of groundbreaking in many ways that, are now gone out to be sort of national organizations like some domestic violence programs, some Community for Restorative Justice, which is restorative justice in the police force uses restorative justice now, especially with teens. So there's sort of groundbreaking things that were done here in Concord that are now really models for national nonprofits.
Restorative justice.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So it's the belief that sort of first-time offenders, especially youth, when they do something of nature that they could be actually charged with, vandalism, alcoholism, anything that, some kind of reckless, mostly vandalism or robberies. The chief of police here in Concord can decide to, instead of, charging them formally and having a record, they can go through what they call restorative justice, which is a program where, and works most well when you have a victim and an offender, and they really believe it started in New Zealand, many years ago before we took it on, but it hadn't been in this country really before.
Hold on just a minute.
Yeah.
The siren
noise.
Okay.
Would you mind taking your wristwatch off?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's clicking.
This microphone just
picks up all the
glass table.
Oh, yeah, right.
Everyone's jewelry.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I was interviewing a real finger tapper one time, and I remembered that I had just purchased
Okay, so restorative justice,
right.
Second chances.
So it's a program that allows people to who have offended people, usually through acts of vandalism or acts of drinking and injury or drinking and ending up in a situation where they've been arrested to make. Whole with the victim, which is either a store owner in a case if you've defaced their property, with a homeowner if you've gone ahead and smashed their mailboxes, to sit down and hear the victim side of the story and how it felt to have themselves victimized. And then the offender, usually a teenager, though it's spread a little bit to adults now, has to make amends by, you know, apologizing and doing some kind of community service to rectify their misdeed.
And where would this take place, this sort of interaction?
At the police station. They have the Community for Restorative Justice has an office right at the police station. And it's a group of volunteers, and they have a director. So those are the kind of things I raised money for, sort of helped get off the ground here in Concord, and which is what makes Concord such a unique town, because there are so many people here. We've sort of always hired, the town's always believed in hiring great people who are innovative and willing to try something outside of the box, and this is an example of that.
That's fascinating. Will you talk more about both the need and the organizations that you were working with?
Sure. I think, you know, because Concord has the hospital, Emerson Hospital here, I think it's a good landing pad for a lot of people who are trying to do work, helping other people. And I think the community chest, which I ran, was really a great catalyst to providing funding fairly simply for startup organizations, or keeping our belief was really the people who know how to do the work are good at what they're doing, but they're not good at raising the money to keep themselves going. So, you know, which is sort of the way the United Way's whole philosophy started as well. And so a lot of organizations came here thinking they had a good idea, and were obviously looking for a foothold here in Concord, either because there were a lot of good people with a lot of abilities to help or volunteer, or there was a good network with the hospital to be able to establish great mental health clinic here, one of the last freestanding mental health clinics probably in the state. We have a great food pantry program, Open Table, all volunteer run. And I was really on the forefront of developing two programs totally based out of what we were seeing not happening in town. And both of these programs, one's going to be on the front page of the Concord Journal today, but we had some suicides with our teenagers. Our first significant one was probably 12 years ago. And this is, again, sort of harkens back to, you know, a nice, wealthy town like Concord has those in need. And this was a mom in public housing. We have a large percentage of single moms in public housing here that are Section 8 vouchered, which means that they are told they want housing, but they're told they need to go where they need to go. And some people are happy to end up in Concord because the school systems are good, but a lot of people are not happy to be in a situation where their kids are exposed to a lot of other wealthy children. There's no transportation. So this young boy committed suicide on Father's Day, hung himself in his bedroom. The police arrived there, and the table was covered in unpaid bills. And apparently this boy was very distraught about his mother's inability to find work and financial situation. Dad was out of the picture. And so I convened all the major players in town, and that was the police chief, the head of public housing, the town manager, the recreation department, and said, how does something like this happen? What are we missing, and how can we help? And we really found out that the head of public housing said there is no good support system for parents in public housing, that there's a, you know, they're given a house here in a town, and that's it. And, you know, there's a lot else that needs to support that. And so we started, I said, well, I think one, the man, gentleman said, I think we can, if we had a town social worker, we could really address helping some of these people in public, mostly in public housing. So they said, we don't have the money. Will the community chest fund it? So I went to my board of directors, and we founded the community outreach coordinator which is a town-run position now, but funded in its entirety by the community chest. And now the town is just picking up some of the hours because there's such a need for her now that they've increased the hours from 20 to 40 hours a week. And this woman just helps people. It's free of charge to any town resident, and they can. She focuses a lot on her work around public housing and affordable housing, which is affordable housing is really, you know, if you're building high market apartments, you can relatively charge less for, you know, some units, and you know that make them affordable. But there's still a stretch for some people. So she provides help with getting food stamps, finding medical help, finding fuel assistance, mental health clinics, clothing, housing. And so that was one of the kind of positions that was able to be started here because we had people who really cared, people who were willing to say, yes, we can do this, and an organization like the Community Chest that said, okay, yes, and we can fund it. So that was a great, you know, way to start a program here that is now taken off in other towns. You're seeing surrounding towns now decide they need community social workers as well that are really helping populations that are maybe immigrants that have moved here who have no way of knowing how to work the system. And just if you're in need and trying to get Medicaid or Medicare or food stamps, or even fuel assistance, the amount of bureaucratic red tape is amazing. And so that was one position we started. And then 3 years ago, we had another rash of suicides at the high school. We had three or four children commit suicide again within a fairly short period of time. And again, I was able to convene all the players and mostly the school. Parents were outraged, kind of really focusing on what the schools were missing in these kids' deaths. And the head superintendent of schools said, this isn't just a school problem. This is a community problem. You know, we have these kids 6 hours a day, but the community has them 24 hours a day. So we really decided we needed a youth coordinator or a youth worker for the town of Concord. It had been tried on and off before. And so the superintendent of schools turned to me and said, Astrid, I want this to happen. I want you to fund it and the town to manage it. So we now have a youth coordinator who works with our community outreach person in the same building. And she's really focused on resources for kids in need and really helping support the schools with education and opportunities for kids and really hoping to, you know, sort of help kids from falling through the cracks or have parents have resources to help their kids. So those are two programs that we're really allowed to get going here without a lot of red tape, and which is what really makes Concord, you know, resourceful and innovative. And we have great town managers, great police chief that are willing to really, you know, see that things need to happen and work to make them happen. So it was really the beauty of my job, which is why I think they asked me to come and talk to you today, because I've worked so much with sort of that population of people in Concord. And the population of people in need, well, it's sort of the combination of working with other town officials, but also really, you know, seeing the amount of need that's out there, seeing the kind of organizations that are helping, you know, people, you know, in need, or, you know, from a recreation standpoint to a lot of work with the elders. We have a, you know, as we do in this whole country, a huge growing population of senior citizens. And I'd say 40% of our funding went to helping with Meals on Wheels, elder abuse, elder daycare. And so we have, you know, significant organizations that do that kind of work here as well. So I think it was a really unique opportunity to run a really locally based kind of umbrella organization to sort of be in the know of who was doing what and who wasn't and what things needed to be done in a relatively contained area and make a huge difference. Domestic violence, the rate of domestic violence in Concord is per capita the same as it is in Boston. Again, something that people just don't, you know, see. As we always say, there's a long driveway without a lot of, you know, neighbors don't hear the commotions. So I think it's been really eye-opening to try to get people to pay attention to that in a town where everyone loves all the, you know, great trails we have and the beauty and the history, and really, you know, also focus on those things that are not working so well and make them better.
How? I mean, that's so important. How do you address that?
Well, I think just allowing, I mean, again, the police chief at the time, who's no longer the police chief, Len Weatherby, really believed in, along with community restorative justice, in the domestic violence issue, and really felt there was a problem here. So he wanted the community chest to fund a domestic violence program, which is now expanded from Concord to serving probably 20 communities in the surrounding area. And we have an executive director of the Domestic Violence Victims Assistance Program. And she trains advocates so that anytime there's a domestic violence call or there's a suspicion of domestic violence, the police are hand, you know, cards to the abused and say, you know, we'd love you to be in touch with our program here. They've got great resources.
Such as?
Well, you know, obviously the ability is to, one, to figure out, you know, how bad the situation is, and if you would like to leave, how are we going to help you leave? They will also have advocates come and sit with people in court, which is, they're all, you know, volunteers from Concord, because that is, you've heard even nationally lately with the NFL, you know, victims are very reluctant to, one, admit there's a problem, two, prosecute against it, and three, leave. And the culture here has really become, we'll help you leave. We'll help you feel safe. We'll help you. We'll go to court with you. You know, don't not file that restraining order. File the restraining order. We'll sit with you in court and help you go through with that process. So, again, something that I feel was unique to Concord when it started. And now every town and police, you know, really out of the police offices, have this program, Domestic Violence Victims Assistance, in place and use these advocates to help victims. And it can be women, it can be children, it can be parents of who are being abused by their teenagers. I mean, there's, you know, husbands that are being abused by wives, elderly people who are in an abuse situation. So, and the community chest, for example, you know, gives them $45,000 a year to help with that kind of programming. And we are probably the largest funder of many of the programs that are helping people in this town, you know, with it, programs that have under $1 million budget. The community chest is probably their largest sole grantor, which in every year everyone has to apply for grants. So it's not a given that you're going to get this money year after year. But so it was a great opportunity to really make a huge difference in a town where it was hard to see the difference needed to be made in some cases. But and just have the opportunity to work with really great people who believe in helping other people as well. And you know, we've kind of always been associated with Thoreau and Walden Pond and our environmental causes, but there are a lot of people doing great work here that are trying to better, you know. We have probably one of the largest ARC programs in the state, too, Minuteman ARC, which is the Association for Retarded Citizens. Or, you know, they you see them employed in a lot of our stores here. They run a big dayhab program out of West Concord. So they have a lot of housing here in Concord.
ARC.
It's a national program, but the one here, Minuteman ARC, is probably one of the largest.
Okay.
largest in terms of?
How many residents are helping? How many, you know, people they're helping? And they have a big, big early intervention program, which is really reaching kids between the age of 6 months and 3 years, kind of, you know, getting intervening before they, you know, get really developmentally delayed or, you know, have problems with walking, talking. And so, again, we gave them $60,000 a year in funding. Elliott Mental Health Clinic, which is the only, you know, mental health clinic with sliding scale fee. The community chest, again, gave them $60,000 a year. So anyone who wanted mental health, you know, a big barrier to getting mental health is I can't afford counseling. And we've obviously made great strides in Massachusetts with our Affordable Care Act, you know, which is why it's important for the country. But so people here can access more health and mental health services than in many places. But when I first started this program, a lot of people were not getting counseling. A lot of the kids from the high school who needed therapy, parents couldn't afford it. They just didn't do it. So if anyone came and needed mental health counseling and psychiatric evaluation and medication, they were able to afford it because of our funding for that.
Are there class issues in how local residents respond to mental health services?
Absolutely. I mean, I think mental health is, still a big taboo in this country in general. And I think, you know, it's not, you know, suicide in itself, as I think you'll see. I'm quoted in the Concord Journal today. We're doing a big walk out of darkness. It's a suicide prevention, national suicide prevention program. But we're going to be the regional walk in 2 weeks. And we have the Carlos Avaderos, whose son was committed suicide. He was the Boston Marathon famous guy with the cowboy hat who helped save the guy whose legs were blown off in the bombing and at the Boston Marathon. Well, he's coming out because his son committed suicide after his other son died in Afghanistan. But, you know, his message has always been about his son's death, but he got famous because of saving somebody else at the Boston Marathon bombing. But as I say in the journal, that mental health is still very much of a stigma. And I think that people, you know, the schools, most of my work really took place with, you know, the school seeing kids coming to school depressed or self-medicating and parents being in total denial that their kids are suffering from depression, suffering from anxiety disorders, or the parents are themselves, and it's all swept under the rugs. The middle school principal came to me and said, I have kids who tried to commit suicide the night before, and their parents sent them to school the next day and tell me, don't tell me. You know, and I see, and they're in denial, and therefore they expect us to fix it, or we don't know there's a problem, and they're failing out of school. So I think, and a little bit of a different stigma than in other towns where you may see a lot of people at a lower socioeconomic rung, sort of, there's a different atmosphere about mental health and it's how it's treated, but at this level, everyone's perfect, you know. Our kids are all at a very high-performing high school. We all want them to go to very, you know, high-performing colleges. And, you know, there's no depression here. It's all rah-rah. And so I think really identifying those kids that are in need and or parents that are in need and helping provide the services, it takes a lot in a town like this to be able to admit that you're not doing well or your kids aren't doing well mentally. And one thing, if they go and, you know, have a football injury or concussions are now a big thing here, you know, but that, you know, they deal much more seriously with that kind of issue than if your kid's having a breakdown or using drugs. I mean, that they just don't want to hear about. And want to ignore. So, you know, having resources in a town like this are critical, but getting people to access them because of the stigma attached with it is very hard.
Do you have higher degrees in social work? I mean, how could you have prepared yourself to deal with all of these levels of social stuff that you have dealt with?
I have an undergraduate degree in sociology and psychology, so which was, you know, I did a brief stint in social work in Barry, Vermont, in the Department of Vermont's, you know, social services, and I thought, I can't do this every day. This is really tough. And I was actually dealing with a lot of other social workers who were burned out, you know, like, oh, don't, you know, forget her. You know, they're always in here with some problem or another. So I was sort of disillusioned pretty quickly. So I went on to get my master's degree at Lesley University in Cambridge in Master's of Science in Nonprofit Management. So it was a great way to meld my love of taking care of people, but removing it by one step and sort of helping support the people who are really on the front lines, you know, and being able to say, yes, I've seen that need, I understand it's out there, and I can support you in doing your work by raising the money to get you, you know, to have the, you know, so you can do your job, which is sort of the whole, which is great for people who are trying to feed 150 people here every Thursday night at First Parish Church. You know, these are great volunteers who love to serve dinner to guests, but they don't know how to go out and ask people for money to do it and to, you know, run the food pantry. So, you know, the Community Chest was giving them $25,000 a year so they can go buy meat and eggs and milk and stuff that is, and I've sort of partnered with a local Gaining Ground, which is a local garden, organic gardens, who brings them, you know, fresh produce, organic produce to these food pantries.
You support Gaining Ground financially?
Yes. So with about $20,000 in funding a year, mostly for help staff. I mean, they're big volunteer program as well. And then we said to Gaining Ground, we've got all these people in public housing that are ashamed to go to Open Table. They don't want to be seen at Open Table on Thursday night, but they would love the access to fresh food. So they set up with our community outreach person behind her building on Saturday mornings. It's called Food for Families. And any family from public housing can go there on Saturday mornings during, you know, growing season and get fresh produce without having to go to the food pantry.
How was that need identified?
It was really between Gaining Ground and an Open Table who were kind of saying, Gaining Ground saying, we have a lot of produce that we're actually sending into Boston, but we still think we're not getting everybody here in Concord that could access. I mean, I think as we've all know, that those at poverty level are probably poor eaters, either because of cost, especially for organic produce. And so Gaining Ground said, I think we can use our produce better out here, in addition to what we're giving to Thursday night programs. And our community outreach person said, I'm happy to put a letter out to all the people I know that are here in vouchered housing. And it's been oversubscribed every summer for the last three summers. So they take about 40 families.
Oh, it's a subscription.
Well, I mean, all you have to do is sign up. There's no cost.
To go behind that.
Yeah,
building.
Right. You know, so they really they can control how much, you know, that the people that really need it are getting it, and then people are committed to coming every Saturday and getting
the
food.
How many folks do that?
About 40 families. So multiple bags of produce every Saturday, I think, till probably the end of October.
40 out of, I wonder how many are in.
So I think they're probably about now about 60 units of public housing. So it's a large percentage that are actually accessing the food. Or, you know, and everyone has, you know, I think if someone wanted it and couldn't get it, they'd be encouraged to go to Open Table on Thursday nights. And Open Table, I don't know if you've heard about that, has they serve a meal, but they also have a pantry, so every person is allowed 2 bags of groceries, which include produce and all, to take home with them every week.
Every person who shows up with a voucher?
Shows up. No questions asked, which is becoming a little bit of an issue, I think, because they're growing so fast. And again, some of these surrounding towns, people know that on Monday night it's Acton is offering that, on Tuesday night it's Bedford, and Thursday night it's Concord. So there is the ability to access these, most of these pantries, without any qualifier. You know, you're not asked to show, whereas, you know, in a lot of places you're asked to show need by, you know, your tax returns or some kind of filing. But Open Table just offers anyone that wants to come for a meal and have groceries to come.
So one or the other or both?
Right, or both, yeah.
And that's becoming a problem then?
I think it's, yeah, sort of they're out kind of growing the amount of people they can handle a night. You know, I think, you know, they can serve about 150 to 175 dinners a night, but some, especially in the winter months, you see a lot more than that coming through the door. Some people drive out from Boston to get food because they know it's very low entry, you know, point. I mean, it's very easy to get.
So is that taking advantage, are you saying?
I don't know. I mean, I think that would be arguable. I mean, I think as a funder of things like that, I started to argue that point a little bit, that, you know, it's, you might at least want to, I asked them to at least tell me, survey, who's coming through your door? Is it Concord and Carlisle residents, or are you 75% of the people coming from Jamaica Plain? To have some sense of where the need really is and where their services are being used, especially if an organization like the Community Chest is really funding things that help local residents versus people from, you know, another town altogether, and maybe taking away from people who really need it here in Concord because they're either shut out or whatever, so...
So the population in Concord, are we talking about people of color, people who have moved in from out of state? I mean, how are folks getting integrated into the social scene here?
Not really. I think, you know, people, as I said, either come here because of their vouchered housing. You know, they could move here from Virginia, let's say. They move up here because they think they're going to get a job, and they want to get into public housing, which is, you know, you kind of pay whatever you can afford. And they, maybe an immigrant population, would much rather be in a Lowell, where they have more people who've also immigrated from their native country or from their native area. But they say, we've got some affordable housing in Concord. You need to take this if you want a place to live. So they come here. If they have children, it's great because the school systems are very good here. But there's no public transportation. There's no way for a single mom to maybe get, you know, the train into town, but to maybe get to the train or get to a doctor's appointment without a car. So they tend to be isolated. And I know, for example, at Open Table, there was some question about having to go around in vans to pick up some people who couldn't walk to the center of town with their children or get groceries or whatever. So they do provide transportation, or meals will be brought to people's homes if they're unable to get here. So I think that there isn't a lot of integration for people who are really struggling here. They kind of keep their shades closed and they send their kids off to school, but they really stay. A lot of these moms are unable to find jobs or unable to work or without any backup. Many of them are without child support. So we have a great after-school programs here, so that if a mom is working, kids do have a place to go from school till the parent gets home.
And then they're transported?
By the buses, yes, yeah. But again, at 6 o'clock, the mom needs to come get them somehow. So again, that could be a problem.
She has to come get him.
Right, right. There's no way for those children to get home from after-school programs. So that is the biggest issue we're still addressing in Concord, I think, which is we've been talking about for the last 16 years, is transportation, you know, in communities where you really need it. And, you know, it's just been hard to make it work, you know, where people will use the public transportation or it works on a schedule for everybody or, you know, so it's very hard.
How did those conversations go?
I mean, we all agree we need it. It's just figuring out a way to... We actually started one... I'm sure, I don't know, you probably interviewed Phoebe Ham at one point. I don't know if you've interviewed or heard people talk about Phoebe Ham, a long-time resident.
H-A-M-M?
H-A-M, I think. Just long-time resident here. Started a community bus, and it was an old school bus, and, drove around town trying to pick up people to take them to errands. And first of all, it was a huge school bus. It was hard to make it... find drivers for it, and people just weren't using it, So, again, it's been really hard. Everyone agrees some kind of transportation would be great, but no one can figure out how to make it work well and be effective and really get...
And affordable,
right?
I mean, if that's too big, then wouldn't a start be a smaller vehicle?
Right. Our best hope is COA vans, Council on Aging vans. And over 60 can get around pretty well with the COA vans. It's kind of the teenagers and the single moms. But there's been, finding drivers even for the COA vans is tough, because it's all volunteer.
There's no budget, or couldn't be?
They have, the budget's fairly large for COA. In fact, the Community Chest funds 3 positions for the Council on Aging, social work, positions, mental health positions there. So they were just able to finally get a new van that they very much needed. So it's pretty tight.
Why? It's hard for me to fathom in a town like Concord that they couldn't even hire drivers for older folks.
Yeah, I think that it's been really hard to find people that that want that kind of job or that, Yeah, for pay even, Bus drivers, are sort of there's a big crew of them. But for the Council on Aging, it's usually other aging people that are driving these vans. So I think finding someone to just, ideally it would be great if we had a service that would just, anyone, like an Uber, you could call up and say, I need a ride to the doctor's or... I need to ride into the grocery store and have someone at the ready, but there just isn't something that's cost-effective yet to that we've been unable to identify and make work yet. But I know it's sort of on the town; it's on the forefront of the town's planning. So we're definitely keep looking at how we can make it effective and looking at other towns that are in similar situations.
Is there a taxi system?
There is a taxi system. Sunshine Taxi. I mean, they're kind of around, but they'll come and you can call them and they'll come. Again, affordability for some people is a big issue.
Sounds big, so the class divide is hanging on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's opportunities for some people to be here that want their kids to be in a good school, public school system, that are in, have places to live now. But again, it's still, they feel very much divided about, their kid doesn't have the new iPhone 6 and the $100 sneakers. And we have a big Metco program here, too. I don't know if you're familiar with Metco, which is the intercity busing of kids out of Boston to come to school here every day. So there's a divide. It's, these kids are being offered a great education, but they're being bused out of Boston at 5:30 a.m. in the morning and bused back in at night. Their parents aren't integrated into the community. The kids all, I don't know if you've read that great book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting at the Lunch Table Together? I mean, again, they sort of, they hang with their own group of friends or their kids that they've come out from Boston from. They're kind of, again, fighting uphill against, it's great to have a great education, but at what price does that come for your socialization and your, so it's been a great program, but it's also been fraught with problems as well. Again, another class issue, again.
Does the community chest play a role in helping schools unravel that?
We've not really gotten involved in the METCO situation because it's a state-run program. We've helped. I also was president of the Parent Association at my daughter's elementary school and at the high school. So we tried hard to get other local families to be mentors or sponsors of METCO children so that if a snowstorm happened, you know, kids could have, parents from Boston could have, know their kid was going to stay with a Concord family, or football families, you know, would take in a kid who needed to be out here for a Saturday morning practice. A lot of these METCO families don't have transportation either. Our biggest help at the Community Chest was really funding summer scholarship programs. So Concord's school system has a program where if you're falling behind in school, they ask you to come for help for the month of July to catch up on your reading or your science or your math. And a lot of these METCO kids were asked to come and be a part of this program, but then were being shipped back into Boston at noon on every, you know, weekday during the summer to go home and maybe be turnkey. So the Community Chest had a private donor that allowed any kid that wanted to go to after-school summer camp, after they finished their morning summer camp, to attend summer camp. So that was cool. So, you know, it offered the opportunity for about 30 of the METCO kids to stay here and do archery and swim and do the things that any kid loves to do at summer camp.
There must have been quite a price tag on that program.
Yeah, $20,000 for a month, yeah. So
one donor.
Yeah, one donor stepped up. And then the school in the last couple of years has met our match, so we funded 10,000 of it, and the school, public schools are funding 10,000 of it now. So, otherwise, these kids may choose not to come out here for remedial help. You know, parents like, I have to work. I can't have my kid come home in the middle of the day. I mean, some of the streets in Boston aren't so safe. So I'd rather leave them at the Boys and Girls Club in downtown Boston all day than have them come out and get the educational help they need. But this is a great way to... And again, our rec department leader, Danner DeStefano, just said, hey, I'm seeing a huge need here.
The name again?
Danner DeStefano. I don't know if you've interviewed him. He's been in the recreation department here for...
D-A-N-N-E-R?
Right. DeStefano, D-E-S-T-E-P-H-A-N-O.
Mm-hmm. He's been a leader in the rec.
Mm-hmm. For 30 years, I think, yeah.
Concord
Recreation. And... everything he does is sliding scale fee. The amount of scholarships he gives for summer camp, the amount of scholarships they run, the Beattie Center, which is the pool. It's located across from the high school. Anyone over 80 can swim or be a member for free.
B-E-E-D-E.
It's called the Beattie Center. It was a public-private partnership to build a great recreation pool facility.
So the terms again are anyone over
80 can come and swim and exercise for free, and then anyone who would like to exercise and can prove need can have a sliding scale fee to be a member of this town recreation department. And then he also offers after school and summer camp scholarships for hundreds of families that, you know, again, parents are trying to work and kid has nothing to do all summer, so they can come to a full day recreation program.
An organized program.
Yeah, yeah. Very organized, you know, like any summer camp. So the Community Chest gives him $15,000 a year in summer scholarship and then an additional $10,000 for the METCO scholarships alone for summer camps.
At the Beattie Center.
Or at the Concord Recreation Department as a whole. I mean, he can tell you stories about need that, you know, are just horrible. Because his parents have to come in and say, why my kid needs to come to summer camp and why I can't afford it.
The Boston parents, too?
Yes, yeah. I guess they just have to kind of say they're interested in signing up and maybe come out and fill out one piece of paper. They're just committing to sending their kid out here for a remedial reading, you know, every morning for the month of July, so.
But the Concord folks have to make a case for why their kid should
right.
be there.
Right, and you know, either free of charge or at a much reduced rate for camp. So, again, no real, just a story, not a lot of documentation, you know, financial documentation particularly.
Well, you've heard some stories.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So, but it's a perfect balance of being able to make a difference and really see, be in a town that you love to live in and also make a huge difference. And I left the job in December. My dad was dying, so I wanted to spend more time with him. Unfortunately, he died 2 days before I was supposed to leave my job. So anyway, so I've moved on from the community chest now and just working at a local retail store now and then trying to figure out what's next. So, because I really miss being able to help people in that way. So
huge change for you.
Yeah, right, huge change, so. But it was great, you know, and being 16 years, it was a long time, and I felt like the community chest had been around for 67 years. It was time for them to have some new energy as well. So it's just a part-time job. It was a part-time job, and so there are three of us in the office, so it was just good to have them have some new blood and, you know, try to keep it moving forward and raising more money and... Though that's harder to do. Because all these organizations now need more money to run. I mean, we used to be the sole provider of funding for a lot of organizations that now have too big a budget for what we can offer. So,
how much does the community chest?
The annual campaign goal for the last probably 8 years has been $650,000, which we've usually met or come close to. So, but you're looking at budgets of places like this Minuteman Arc or Gaining Ground. That are Minuteman Arc's over probably $3 million. Gaining Ground's budget's at about $75,000. So there's no way we can fill all the gaps that need to be filled. So they're all doing their own fundraising as well.
All right. So how do you raise money? That's what we all want to know.
Right?
What's your secret? What are some of the techniques?
Well, here it's worked well with just we send out an annual appeal, like a letter to every household in Concord. And again, I think the biggest problem in a town like Concord is getting people to realize that there's good things going on in Concord, that two people are in need in Concord, and that it's important that they give here and not give to, the Red Cross, who's dealing with a hurricane halfway around the world. So I think people see international causes, or the call to action right away from the Red Cross, for example, and they send their dollars there versus keeping it local. So I think again, that is the biggest challenge. Think globally, act locally, or I always said think globally, give locally.
Why?
Why give locally?
Yeah.
Because I think that, and as you can see now with some of these, big disaster relief programs, the money's not getting to where it needs to go. It's getting bogged down, whereas here we would say at the community chest, our biggest thing is that we oversee every organization that we're giving money to. We check in with them. We come back to them every year and say, what did you do with our money last year? And when you're right in the town, you can see. I see the domestic violence posters up in the inside stalls at the hospital and the schools. If we send your money halfway around the world, you don't know if those organizations are still in existence or they're doing the right thing. So, it's hard to get people to pay attention. I think our biggest benefit at a place like the Community Chest is its longevity. Our biggest challenge is that as the population ages, the people who sort of started the community chest, who get the community chest way of doing things, are dying or moving, and the younger generation is more focused on their private schools, their kids' soccer teams, their churches. So because the face of what we do is not a structure, it's not like having your name on the side of a hospital. or it doesn't directly affect people, they have a hard time identifying why their money is important to an organization that they don't, may or may not have any affiliation with. Though their kids may volunteer at Gaining Ground, or they may see, you know, you walk into the local grocery store and there's a huge place where you can donate food to Open Table. It's very hard to get them to think about putting their money there as well. So fundraising is tough. And I've sort of got to the point in town where people see me on the street and the street crossing, like, oh, what's she gonna, what does she need from us now? So,
because you would meet people on the
street. Yeah, and say, I really need your commitment. You know, or, I mean, I did was more subtle than that. I mean, I developed great relationships with people, and you know, and I'm passionate about letting people know that there are people here in need. And unfortunately, the trouble is that you don't. Very few people who are really getting the help are want to be anonymous, so they're not. You know, they're not like the Jimmy Fund. They're not on the front page of the newspaper saying I'm fighting cancer. They're not saying I'm fighting poverty or I'm running from my husband. They don't. They want to be anonymous, so it's harder to make that connection for donors, I think. So, but we tell as many stories as we can, or we tell them, you know, we tell them through the volunteers who are having the direct impact, who get the thank you, and they've gone to court with a victim and said I would have never left without the support of my advocate.
So those volunteers will do public speaking then?
They will, yes. They will. They're much more apt to be able to tell the story from an anonymous point of view, but how they can see even more the direct impact than I can as the writer of the check. So.
When we talked about domestic violence and we talked about kids' drug issues mm-hmm. a little bit and feeling the weight of poverty, what about sexual orientation and these suicide stories or mm-hmm. other issues? Is that something that's come up with the community chest?
Not so much. I mean, I think suicide is complicated. So I think the hardest part is figuring out exactly why someone has committed suicide, whether it's a teenager or a, you know, a young adult, you know, a lot of middle-aged men. There's a big statistic there, not so much we've seen in Concord. But I think it sexual orientation, which is a big cause, I think, for suicide in some teenagers. You know, they're struggling with their sexual identity or they've been bullied by that. Again, it's really hard to figure out why these kids are committing suicide with struggles that sometimes parents don't even know about or teachers don't know about. Two of the prominent suicides of 3 years ago were two very highly achieving kids that were in some therapy but were not on anyone's radar screen as a high risk. It's more impulsive in teenagers. Suicidality, you know, they can have a bad go of it and think this is the way out without leading any people to really know what the undiagnosed bipolar, undiagnosed schizophrenia at that point. So the school's been very supportive around sexual orientation and the ability to, they have their own spectrum club at the high school, which is great. There's really support. There are several teachers at the high school that are gay and really support those kids there. So I think there is a safe feeling about that at the high school. But the real cause of what's happening with these kids is hard to... High pressure, I think. You know, they're stressed about performance. They are doing well in school, but it's almost too much pressure. I mean, I read about another suicide at MIT the other day. I mean, again, these kids just somehow seem to think that this is, it's too much, and they can't cry help, and they say, I need to break here. So suicide is an option, or using heroin, or marijuana, or drinking. I mean, there are these ways that a lot of people end up coping with things that they don't understand or are trying to hide.
Are those large issues in Concord? Substance abuse?
Yeah, yes, very much so. No more, I mean, the principal will tell you no more than any high school. Some parents will tell you it's a huge problem at the high school.
What is?
Mostly marijuana use. State of Massachusetts is legalized under an ounce, or you can't. It's not a federal offense now to be caught with an ounce of pot or marijuana on you. They're not, so kids more readily use it, can more readily access it. I mean, we're not Colorado yet, but a lot of kids are dealing it at the high school. We actually brought in dogs a few years ago to do a drug raid, and parents were up in arms about that. Some parents were up in arms that happened, and others were like, it's about time it happened. So it's sort of I would say the new police chief would tell you there was almost an overdose on some new ecstasy drug out there from a kid in Concord. So there's definitely use.
The dogs came before the legalization then?
No, it was after the legalization, but they were trying to sniff out dealers, really. Over an ounce. I mean, I think these dogs are trained to look for big amounts in lockers, and a lot of schools are doing it. But again, parents weren't happy when it was their kid that was sniffed out or whatever. So that's our big next agenda item. I'm on the youth advisory board now for the town of Concord with this youth coordinator position, and we really need to deal with substance abuse. And the schools would be the first to tell you it's a community-wide problem. Parents are setting a bad example. And so it's not only our issue. So we're trying to make it a community-wide issue. And again, how do you address that? And you can hold every program out there. We used to host social liability law parents' nights at the high school, and it's literally preaching to the choir. The kids whose parents are coming to these things aren't the kids whose parents are locking the basement door and bringing out the keg for 16-year-olds. So.
Social liability.
Yeah. So, if you are knowingly allowing alcohol to be in your home for under 21, you could be thrown in jail. And, or God forbid, some kid leaves your house drunk and kills himself or somebody else. And it's been hard to get that message across to parents, even though there have been some big high-profile cases in Massachusetts where that exactly has been done. Parents have been upstairs in the bedroom, supposedly not knowing what's going on, and the kids are having a raging party in the basement, and someone gets killed.
Youth advisory group, huh?
Yes. So that's a town made up board of concerned citizens that help the youth advisory, the youth coordinator, which is a position I helped start, kind of oversee her position, help her. We're all working on this walk out of darkness in 2 weeks. We're helping, do mental health week at the high school. So we're just an overseeing board to a town position. Yeah, I'm keeping my hand in it a little bit, which is great, especially in something I believe in and help start. So,
how is it that Concord is a cradle for this kind of social safety netting, creating these programs, many of which have become national models, and all that? What is it about Concord that's always trying to take it to the next level, I guess you could say?
I think there are just a lot of really educated, smart people that sort of are drawn to Concord, either to work or to live, that really get it. I mean, we're pretty democratic community. I mean, you see, we mostly vote that way. I think we're sort of not every man for himself. We're people who live here. Who, I think it really harkens back to the days of Thoreau and Emerson and, you know, people who really believed in helping mankind, or the belief that, you know, we all have to work together. You know, the patriots, you know, rose to arms to fight the British. I mean, I think there's this real sense of community that people who come here maybe because they love Walden or Emerson or Thoreau are also very socially minded people. So I think you'll see people, and there are well educated who get it, that that helping other people is an important part of making a great community. So I think Concord's has always attracted people like that, you know, from those days of the great authors themselves. And, you know, I think having a community hospital here that's been around for 100 years also, again, brings physicians and administrators that, you know, are really caring about community as well.
Community hospital? Is that a certain category?
It is a community. My husband's a runs the hospital, so I'm very focused on, he's the chief medical officer there. But so community hospital is really, you know, though it serves 20 surrounding towns, it's really, you know, it's a localized hospital that's run by a community board of directors. And they're fewer and fewer of those hospitals. They're all being bought up by bigger healthcare systems. But it, you know, allows people to get their healthcare right in a town and not have to drive into Boston for care. You know, we're close enough that it's easy enough to drive into Boston for care, but Emerson Hospital is still one of the only community hospitals that has a mental health floor and addiction services, for example. So I think, you know, again, people are drawn to live and work around a hospital setting that care about people. So I think it's been and the town's small enough, it's about 18,000 people, that, you know, people sort of feel a big climate change group here. I'm sure you've interviewed some of those people too, or, you know, sort of big people on the forefront of climate change issues too. So it's a real melting pot of environmentalists and human service people in Concord that you don't see in many surrounding towns. And I think it's really comes back to the history of our town and people who helped, you know, found this town sort of believed in that. You know, the Alcotts and all that still, you know, are still, there's still descendants living here who still feel very much the same way. And, you know, longtime families here whose kids, you know, are a little younger than me, who've, you know, really stayed here and are really committed to making this town a great place, you know, still, which is great. They're very, very philanthropic. They're very, you know, willing to dig in and help. So it's very unique that way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, good. I hope I was helpful and gives another sheds a little bit of light on, I know I'm really segmented part of Concord, but important.
It sounds like you've been well accepted and made vast contributions to the town. So thank you for that, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love it. And so it's like you're doing it. Right. Good.
Anything else that you
want to... No, I can't. You know, I'm just, if you're looking at internet research, you can check out the community chest on the website and just see what their, you know, the mission is. It's just cccommunitychest.org. And it gives you a pretty good sense of all the organizations that are here in town and the mission. And if you're just wanting a little bit more of a visual. So.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.